ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there, readers and listeners, and welcome to a summer book special here on ABC Radio National with a great Irish writer and thinker to welcome in the new year. I'm Kate Evans from The Bookshelf, and the writer in question is novelist, poet, essayist and critic Colm Tobin, whose books include The Blackwater Lightship, The Master, The Magician, Testament of Mary, Brooklyn and his latest, Long Island. And his essays, well, they're marvellous, and they touch on everything from Oscar Wilde's Ballad of Reading Gaol, the history of Irish peasantry, Catalan independence, and close readings of political language. Colm Tobin spoke to me at the 2025 Sydney Writers' Festival, and I began, of course, with a hello.
Hello.
I wonder if we can begin with place. Because in your novels, Nora Webster, Brooklyn, Long Island, and I think maybe in the Blackwater Lightship too, we're either in or near the town of Enniscorthy. So can you describe it and the role it has in your imagination?
Enniscorthy is a small town in the southeast of Ireland, and we're from there. And I could say we're from there, meaning that my four grandparents were born there. My parents were born there. My father was a teacher. His brother was the local journalist on the local paper. My two sisters were teachers. And that gave us a sense, I think, of the town and how it worked. So that putting in a fictional name for a town was never something I wanted to do, because I wanted an anchor in topography that would give me a sort of an emotional anchor by saying, when you go down Rafter Street, you turn into the Market Square. If you turn right, and if you turn left, you go up Wafer Street. Now, if you don't have that, if you make up names or you use a sort of a fictional or generic town, you lose that sense that each time you write down the name of a place. For example, in Long Island, where were the telephone booths? Because we didn't have a telephone at home. So where the telephone booths are, and the one that's not working, press button A, press button B, and all that sense of that paraphernalia, one at the bottom of Parnell Avenue, one over there near where the priest, near the man, you know, that those things bring with them some sort of sense of memory, of loss, of place, as you say. And without them in those books, it would be very hard to see how you could get the characters, how you could get a sense of emotional accuracy at the level of intensity I want for those characters.
And it's beautiful, but it also feels quite claustrophobic, and it, as if it stifles ambition. And or at least that's how it felt with Brooklyn, which you wrote in 2009, and the story of Eilish Lacey. Now, she escaped, we thought. So why return to her and to this place in Long Island?
I had someone who was going on to me about adultery and about cheating, and as though I had caused all this in my novel. I mean, I just imagined it, that's all. And I was trying to think of a way to defend myself and the book and the whole idea of, and it was that the God invented adultery so we could have novels. Do you know, in other words, Madame Bovary and Monsieur Bovary, if they're perfectly happily married and laugh at one another's jokes and finish one another's sandwiches, then there's no novel. And so I suppose it's the same idea with if the town is a lovely place where people are very sweet to one another, and if they mind their own business regularly, then you don't get the novel. And also, once I started Long Island, and I started the novel very tentatively, just with that opening business of, you know, there's a problem in her marriage, it suddenly struck me, I could bring her back to Ireland. And I started to do the maths. Could her mother be still alive? Because I'm already working before I'm thinking all this, because I don't know where I'm going to, you know, I'm working on the first section. And I said, oh, wow, doing the maths, her mother could be 80 this year. Wouldn't that be good? It'd be a real reason for going home. And then it comes into my head, could Jim Farrell still be unmarried? And I almost went into the church, you know, to say, God, if you could help me with this, or, you know, please keep Jim unmarried just between now and the time I finish this book. So, you know, in other words, you don't have a novel unless you have her return. And if her return is to be easy, if her mother is to embrace her and they're to just discuss old times for the whole summer, that's not a novel either. You know, you need all sorts of twists and turns. And and the town is stifling and claustrophobic, but yet Jim and Nancy in Long Island, I'm not giving the plot, I mean, it's the opening of the book, they're having a pretty torrid love affair at night by just crossing the Market Square really quickly in the shadows. So no one knows they're doing this, or so they feel.
Well, you mentioned that beginning in Long Island, and it begins with a knock on the door. And so, can you talk about how you write that moment, like before and after that knock on the door? How do you imagine that?
I've been teaching the 19th century novel, and I do a seminar. And because I have no theory of anything, the only way I can do the seminar is by reading the book really closely the week before. And I was doing Thomas Hardy's The Mayor of Casterbridge. And The Mayor of Casterbridge is where a man and his wife and their daughter in about 1830 walk into an English town or village, and there's a fair, and their people are putting things up for auction. And the man has a lot to drink, and by the end, he puts his wife up for auction and says, who will buy this woman? And it's awful, you know, everyone's watching, and suddenly over to the side, over to there, there's a dark stranger, handsome, and he says eventually, I'll buy her. And that evening, that man, his wife, the wife and the stranger and the daughter walk out of the town, leaving the drunk husband behind. Now, I was reading it and thinking, is there any chance you could do that now? Is there any novel you could think of? You know, in other words, all the excitement of that plot business, we've handed over to detective novels and to murder novels, and that's all fine, but I wanted to know if I don't know anything about murder, so I was wondering if I could do it without murder. Also, I have a lot of really smart colleagues at Columbia University, and they all have PhDs, which I don't have. And one of them wrote a book about the novel. So I thought, oh, God, I should learn something. And I read it. And he has a thing about plot. What is plot? A plot is an action that has consequences. So the plot part is not really the action as much as the consequences, which are dictated, which are allowed, and which must occur as a result of the original action, such as the man putting his wife up for sale. It's not that. That's not the important thing. The important thing is, years later, the consequences of that will make up the sort of emotional structure of the novel. I thought, I wish I could do that plot. And he quotes someone saying, plot schmott, meaning plot's over for a lot of writers. And so I thought, a knock on the door is a good thing to start, a folk tale. There was one winter night, a stranger came to the door and knocked on it. I think, well, that's a good start. So who would come to the door? And then I thought, well, here's Elise Lacy. You know, I've written about her before. She's in her nice house on Long Island. Her husband's out, her kids are out. And there's a man been looking for her. So it opens with this, that Irishman's been looking for you. Irishman. And he's Irish for the simple reason that I can't write American dialogue. And I mean, we should be able to, all of us, write American dialogue, considering the amount of stuff from Dallas to, you know, all sorts of The Godfather and stuff we had to watch. But I can't do it. I get words wrong. I get tone wrong. So he's Irish. And he comes to the door of her house. She opens it and looks at him. He's a big fella from Donegal. And he looks at her and says, are you the wife of the plumber? You know, in an ignorant Donegal accent. And she didn't know what to say. But eventually what he says is that your husband came to our house to do the plumbing. And my wife is pregnant. And I'm not the father. Your husband is. And if you think that I'm having this brat brought up in my house, where with my children who were decently conceived, that I'm not. And I'm the minute the baby is born, I'm bringing the baby up here and I'm leaving it here, or I'm handing it to you. You can deal with it. It's a bit of a shock. Imagine if someone came to your door and did that. You know, it would be a bit of a surprise, to say the least. And it's also, of course, from a novelist's point of view, completely melodramatic. Like, it's really outlandish. And you think, I wrote it during the pandemic is the only excuse I have for it. You know, there were long days where you could think, I'll try anything today. You know, the tedium of the day, just break up the tedium. And you know, this is before all the pill, all the, you know, inject. And when it was done, I thought, well, that's, I'll leave that. I won't even read it. And then I realized that the next section could be a way of rescuing it. That if you made her quiet, if you had nothing happen in the next 8 pages, except she's alone in the house, trying to deal with what's just been happened, and she doesn't speak, she doesn't make tea, because there's too much of that in Irish novels, that she doesn't just do anything, and that I could rescue it slowly if I was very, very careful. And so that was the idea, and here we are now.
Well, as you say, there's that the melodramatic moment, that wonderful moment of the knock on the door, and then you change tone and you quieten it down. And so then I started to notice all the doors, all the hinges, all the openings in this novel. And there's this wonderful moment when she does get to Ireland, and the thing that's blocking the door in her mother's house is all these white goods that her mother doesn't really need. So can you talk about what's blocking the doorways for Eilish?
I suppose in 1976, I'm 21. So it's probably the last summer in full that I spent in Enniscorthy. So I know what pubs people went to. I know what people said. I know what people did. And one of the big problems that arose at home was, we didn't have much money, was the electricity bill. It wasn't that, maybe the prices were going up, but no matter what happened, my mother would go nuts when the bill came in every 2 months. Say, there's something eating electricity in this house. And then she'd say, turn off that light, it's eating electricity. Turn off that electric fire, put it one bar, it's eating electricity. And everything was eating electricity. And there was talk then of getting various things, like a tumble dryer. In Ireland, if you don't have a dryer in the house, there's no drying outside because it's raining, and even in the summer, and so therefore you have to get a dryer. But that dryer is eating electricity. And so the whole business of white goods coming into the house was not merely a gift to you, but a burden on you. And you say, that fridge, you know, and point at anything electrical, that toaster, that iron, you know, anything that was. And so I thought, what could she do that would disrupt the peace on arrival in Enniscorthy after 20 years in America? She would realize her mother doesn't have a fridge, her mother doesn't have a washing machine, and her mother does not have a proper oven. So she just decides on the jet lag moment to buy them for her as a big surprise. What an idiotic thing to do, because her mother, when she sees them, said, I didn't order those. And then says, I haven't been waiting. You know, it isn't as though I've been sitting here waiting for you to come home so I could have these things. And so a lot of tension begins, but the things get delivered. And the mother obviously wants them, but she doesn't want to let her daughter know she wants them. So she has them left in the hallway. She won't have them installed. And of course, every time they try and come in the door, they're blocking the way. Now, the most important thing for me is that's not a metaphor. In other words, that yes, later you could see there are a lot of doors, blocked spaces, but for me, the first thing to do is to make those three things that are in the hall real. And, you know, that it's a fridge blocking the way before it's a sort of an idea that between daughter and mother, there are ways being blocked. I have to be very careful with that the detail always has to be a thing rather than a thought.
And so you said that you're also writing your way into real streets and streets of memory and places and so on. What does that mean for the people of Enniscorthy? Are you writing people who you remember, people that you knew, or are you inhabiting it all with imagined people?
Well, the stuff about the electricity is my mother. You know, there's no imagination. And the initial idea for Brooklyn really came from two things. One, that in the years I wrote those books, Nora Webster and Brooklyn, and indeed Long Island, but the first two more, there were the years after my mother and her sisters had died. And it was a question of, you know, being at those funerals and thinking, well, that won't come back, you know. That those Sunday afternoons when the two of them would visit my mother and there'd be a lot of talk upstairs, and Auntie Harriet would almost have bought a coat in Dublin, and there'd be all filled with what was wrong with the buttons and was it on a sale in Cleary's, and the whole business of the discussion, it won't come back. And it's gone. And so writing those books, there was an element of seeing if you could get it back, if you could just get moments of it. And then you lie in bed and you think, imagine if Auntie Harriet, my mother's younger sister, if she'd gone to America, what would it have been like for her? Just that simple dream thing that a kid could do. But the other one was more serious. It's where my father died in the summer of 67 when I'm 12. And a lot of people came to the house in the time between then and Christmas of that year. And my job was to answer the door and take coats. And there was a lot of talk in the room. It would begin very simply with someone saying to my mother, you know, I'm very sorry for your trouble, or condolences or something, and then they would talk. And one evening a woman came and she had a handbag and she was always rummaging in it, and there were letters from her daughter in Brooklyn. Not Manhattan, not New York, not America. Brooklyn and Brooklyn, Brooklyn, showing the letters to my mother. And then when that woman, often the best part of life in a way, the best part of the evening, was when people would leave and you could talk about them. It wouldn't be scandalous talk because there were children in the room. They'd always be very careful with that. But it would be, someone said about that woman that her daughter, who went to Brooklyn, came back once to Enniscorthy, and she, on the boat between America and Ireland, she took the ring off her finger because she had married on an impulse in New York. There was a fellow who was so crazy about her, he said, don't go home. Or if you go, marry me before you go. And she did. But then she realised on the boat that it would break their hearts in Enniscorthy because they presumed she was coming home for good. And so that's all I knew, that this had happened. I didn't know what time of the year it was. I didn't know how long. I didn't know anything else. And 40 years later, I started to write that story. Part of it was that I got an offer of a job teaching in Texas for a semester. And Texas is hard, you know. They're very friendly and nice. And I got homesick. And it was not just, you know, you got homesick, funny, for things in Ireland you don't even like. You know, drizzle. There's no drizzle. I mean, Texas, it doesn't drizzle in Texas. And, like the Irish news, you know, the beeps of the Irish newsreaders, all the things you just don't want when you're in Ireland. Irish bread and Irish food. And I just grew homesick. So when I came home, I found that I had written that little story of the girl who went to Brooklyn in the novel Nora Webster as an effort to show the sort of conversations that were going on in the house after my father died, because the novel Nora Webster is about my mother in those years. And suddenly here it was, a story about homesickness, a story about someone leaving, a story about someone coming back. And I just stopped writing Nora Webster and I started writing that. I didn't know whether it was going to be a novel or a story or how long, and it became Brooklyn. And then I was in New York and I was signing copies of the book. It had just come out, it was out a few months. And there was a woman came to get a book signed in NYU. And she looked at me, she was very nice, and she said, I think that's my mother. And I said, a lot of that had begun to happen where, strangely, a lot of Irish, there's an oral history of Brooklyn, and people talk about their lives in the 50s. And one guy says that every Italian young man wanted an Irish girlfriend. And I remember reading it and thinking, if people at home had known that in the 50s, women, they would have left en masse. I mean, there would have been it would be called the national stampede to get out of Ireland so you meet a nice, clean Italian in New York. Certainly, anyone I know, parents would have just... I mean, it would never have been their parents because they would have had an Italian father. And I said to her, you know, was your mother Irish and she married an Italian? And she said, no, I really think that is my mother. And I said, where was your mother from? I said, where you're from, Enniscorthy. And I said, what was your mother's name? And she said a name. And I said, that was your mother. And your grandmother came to our house and told that story, or that story was told about her. And she was puzzled because I got some of the story wrong, obviously, because I only knew what I'd heard. And so we talked about that a bit, and she was very nice about it. I mean, that's how that story got pieced together. First, the homesickness mine. Secondly, another thing would be, I was trying to write about the sort of figures that appear in, say, Jane Austen's Mansfield Park or Henry James's, Washington Square, where you have a young woman who's not strong, who's not headstrong, who's not courageous, who's not especially brainy, who's not especially beautiful in her own estimation. And she goes to America, you know, she seems to prevail by dint of the way she notices, by because she feels very deeply. So it's all interior stuff. And the novel is very good at getting that idea of someone who's ostensibly shy or ostensibly powerless and easy to bully, maybe, and who's not obviously self-conscious, and to try and give them an interior life that's as rich as you can manage. So all those things came together, and I wrote that book.
I remember reading Brooklyn when it first came out, and I had a friend, and we debated with each other about what we wanted Eilish to do, whether to stay in Brooklyn or return. And I remember I felt very strongly that I wanted her to stay in Brooklyn. I didn't want her to return. And then when I returned to it and read Brooklyn again, I had a different sense of it. And I wonder how much your sense of these characters might have changed when you're having to revisit them for Long Island.
I think the big difference is the difference between the 50s and the 70s. You know, the only person we knew who was divorced in Enniscorthy was Elizabeth Taylor. Do you know, in other words, the idea of a married woman, and you say, and she a married woman. There was, no matter what you did, being a married woman brought with it enormous responsibilities. There seemed to be no pleasure in it at all. And the idea of the ring and what she's done really does govern that. It's not merely about her being a Catholic. It's just about the way things were. And once you go into the 1976, no one seems to... That doesn't bother anybody. And so that's the big change in the things. She doesn't really, I think, have a choice. What she does is she lives for that summer as though this looming problem isn't there. And the weather is nice, and it just seems a miracle that this Jim Farrell in the town has come her way. And there is a dream she has of belonging, of living in a town where everyone will know who she is. Her mother is close by. You know, she's the wife of a publican, which would be a big deal in a small town. I mean, and that she would be settled and she would be there and she would see her friends and all their children would grow up together. I mean, I was at something at home in October, and there were a group of us all getting to the age of 70, and we had a lunch together. And we all made terrible speeches. Mine was the worst. And someone said, you know, one strange thing about us is all of our parents knew each other. What a strange idea of a group of people being able to meet age 70. Someone could say that. And so the idea that she could have that life where her children would be able to say that instead of going back to a place where, as we discover in Long Island, she would always be a stranger, you know. And so she has a dream for the whole summer. It's a summer novel. So is Long Island, that, you know, that things are going to be okay. And then she realizes that, you know, well, things happen, you know.
Things happen, but things aren't necessarily talked about, which is part of the pleasure of these novels, of course, is that if everybody spelt everything out, it would, you know, things might be resolved. But that, I mean, there's a sense of that you're listening to stories and that there's a whole Irish culture of storytelling. But then inside houses, people aren't saying things.
Yeah. I mean, it's in the Blackwater Lightship where someone is talking about being gay and, you know, being gay in a small town and being gay in the family, and then says, you know, in my family, my brothers and sisters, the straight ones, they haven't even told my parents that they're heterosexual. You know, like, it's like we just don't talk about things, you know. And certainly in Long Island, that, you know, she comes home from America, she's having trouble with her marriage. She doesn't want to tell her mother this because her mother will go on about it all the time. Also, it's just, she just doesn't know what to say about it. And so too, Jim and Nancy in the novel Long Island have a long engagement, which has died out everywhere, really. But people in Enniscorthy in the 70s even would get engaged. They could even get secretly engaged or get engaged on New Year's Eve, but not get married until. So it was, an engagement was such a big thing. And so they have a secret engagement for a really good reason. And so there's an awful lot of people not telling things. But the main thing is that the reader knows everything. So you're playing a game with the reader, me the writer, you the reader, we know exactly what's happening. But watch the way Eilish hasn't guessed this. If she just looked behind, there's a wedding and there's a moment, if Nancy just looked over, Nancy, look over, you'll see everything. But Nancy's too busy doing something else. And the reader is watching this. And so you're building a novel for a reader. In other words, you've got three characters mainly, and you have a reader. And you're always watching. Make sure the reader knows. Make sure the reader knows. And then the reader takes... So there's an idea of trying to do a choreography around knowing, not knowing, who knows nothing and who knows everything.
Well, and with Nancy, the reader is beside herself. I mean, I love Nancy as a character, but you get so sort of anxious for her. She breaks your heart in a way. Tell us about Nancy.
Well, there's a new word. Every so often in America, a new word. I mean, let's not talk about America, but there's a word called transactional. I never knew about that before, you know, that a love affair could be transactional. And I had to go home and think about that transactional. Like, and then, oh, right, I think I know what that means. So that you open Nancy, you give her, the first thing you need to give her is that in her chip shop, which is a fish and chip shop, where she makes chips, meaning fried potatoes, and for drunken people in the town to come and soak up all their alcohol late at night. And then obviously the people around go nuts because it gathers every drunken, you know, nuisance in the town is in the square. But it's an awful job. And it's late at night, and the smell of oil, she lives upstairs, gets into her clothes. Anyway, you need to establish that early on to say that this woman would love to be married to a nice rich man, or reasonably rich, and have a nice life. You can see why. She's a widow, and so that Jim is exactly out of her dreams. And they're both in their 40s, and it would be a great move for her to get out of the chip shop into just comfort and luxury.
She's imagining a house.
She imagines, instead of imagining, you know, like Jim's ruby lips or something, she imagines the house and where she's going to put the sofa and where the bed, and there'll be a long room. So she's filled with these plans, like she's become an architect overnight. And she loves him as well. But the reader has got to be able to see that this really makes sense for her. And we're on her side. She's a very good-hearted person, and we're on her side. And then suddenly, you know, there was another book I was teaching, which is The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton, where a woman, there's a marriage going to occur in New York in a settled community, and everyone agrees it's a good marriage. And then from Europe comes the Countess Olenska to break up. She's glamour personified. She's exotic, and she's going to break up the peace. And so too in this one, the other way around across the Atlantic, comes Eilish. And they presume she's rich. They presume she's got dollars. You know, she doesn't really, but she's whatever she's done, she looks great. And the minute she arrives, she's an outsider and an insider. So you're back with the folk tale where there was a wedding, and into the wedding, at the wedding party, came in a stranger, and which is what she is, because no one at the wedding really knows how to talk to her. She's moving alone. And therefore, that idea of disruption, of what comes in to disrupt the peace, is, of course, an American. And, you know, that whole idea of, if you think about all our cultures, we're so disrupted by the arrival of America.
With her sunglasses and her crisp cotton. But this town and these people who you've returned to in a number of novels, the other thing that you return to again and again is your own bookshelves. I mean, you mentioned Edith Wharton, but, you know, you've looked at Henry James in The Master, and you've looked at Thomas Mann in The Magician. So is that another... I mean, what's that about? Is it about animating your own bookshelf?
Yeah. I wrote a novel about Henry James called The Master, and I wrote it after I wrote a novel called The Blackwater Lightship. It's a very intense novel, again, set back in Enniscorthy. Six characters over 7 days in a house on the Irish coast. Recrimination, rosary, making tea, annoying each other, bringing up old grudges, all sorts of trouble. When it was done, a lot of rain outside and recriminate. You know, I thought, I just never, ever want to know anything about this again. I don't want any more Irish weather and Irish people and all sort of Irish sounds of things that people say. And I just went away from it. And I thought, wouldn't it be great? The Henry James novel came then, meaning I could go to Venice rather than go into my own heart where I was fed up. And I could go and, you know, write about duchesses, and Henry James is such a powerful figure, and his family was so rich, and he was... I thought, wouldn't it be a great relief just to get away, not have a single Irish person speak, and you see, you end up using things that are very close if you're writing a novel set in your own town, things about loss, things about memory, things that are unresolved. And it's not like going to a psychiatrist, but it is about dredging things that are highly emotional and you know, highly fraught, really, and therefore going to this Henry James novel was a way of just making sure the next few years I don't have to think about it. But then, of course, it has its own emotional resonance, but not as much, and it was a literary exercise in a whole lot of different ways.
But what about The Magician? What about turning to Thomas Mann? I mean, obviously it is a literary exercise, but is it, I mean, is it fan fiction? I mean, is it a way of thinking about what books matter to you, what writers matter to you?
It's fan fiction, yeah. The number when I was about 70, between about 17 and 25, you know, the books you read those years often stay with you in the way other books don't. And I would have read Thomas Mann in those years. I would have read Henry James in those years. In a way that I wasn't reading other books. It wasn't that I was reading voraciously. Those two writers stuck with me. And maybe a few others, James Baldwin. Anyway, I just presumed that writers were very powerful people who were very deliberate and very stable. And they went every day and they worked on their books and they knew what they were doing and they got photographed once or twice. And Henry James grew fat and they died. You know, and you can see the dates, this date and then this date. And I didn't realise that it's the opposite, that they were writing out of fear, they were writing out of unresolved experience. And this emerged in the case of both of these gentlemen, Henry James and Thomas Mann, when their diaries, Thomas Mann's diaries appeared, and you realise that he was actually homosexual. And he's got six children. Now, I don't know how that's done. And he's constantly thinking about sex. And they're in there, and he wants the diaries. He also wants the diaries to be published 20 years after his death. It's not, you know. And in the case of Henry James, his letters he wrote, really embarrassing letters to young men, telling them how much he wanted to hold them. And this is these are two of the most respectable men in the world. And so the biographers set to work. Biographers arrive in and set to work, and to dismantle the high reputation, you know, of the. And so you learn an awful lot. You learn an awful lot about how the novels were made, that they were often made out of pain, they were often made out of loss, they were often made out of things that they could not resolve for themselves. And so I thought that was an amazing idea. And in both cases, I thought I could work with that. Levels of ambiguity, where you could never be sure about the motive. Thomas Mann was a great Democrat in the Hitler period, and in the Second World War, he was a big spokesman for a democratic Germany of the future. But in 1914, he was a monarchist and an anti-democrat. And watching that change occur, I suppose that idea of watching an individual change, where you have it so charted, because he wrote so many letters and kept these diaries and wrote these novels and essays. And so I could work with that. It was a big challenge to work with an individual life. And I didn't have the responsibility of a biographer, meaning I didn't have to say, in March he went there and then in April. Because if it bored me, I went on to the next year. But I had to stick to facts. I had to give you a scaffolding of let's say, truth or fact. Like Thomas Mann had six children.
Which and is some real, of them were extraordinary.
Yes, but only three of them were. The other three are complete bores. And it's a nightmare. And it's a nightmare for any novelist to have six children. No novel. Think of any novel. No novel has six children because it's too hard to keep all those up in the air all the time. And you think, oh, Monica, I haven't mentioned her for two chapters. Bring Monica. And where's Michael? The reader's going to forget he even exists. And but the pact with the reader is, if Thomas Mann had six children, you have to give him six children in your novel.
But, I mean, in a way, I remember reading that novel and being so taken by some of those children. And they felt like they were main characters who were sort of wanting their own novel. But you resisted that. I mean, was it because it was always Thomas Mann's work?
Yeah, that his two eldest children were too easy to read. That they what happened was that after the First World War in Germany, no one wanted to listen to their parents talk at all. No one wanted to hear rules. It had been so militaristic, so Prussian, and so led by an older generation that were so wrong, led by the Kaiser into this awful war. So the Mann children were at exactly the right age in 1920. To behave outrageously. And of course, their father gave them money and they became poster children. They did what they liked, they said what they liked, they dressed what they liked, and they slept with anyone they saw. And they wrote about this all the time. So they became more famous than their father in about 1922 or 1923. People would say, oh, you're the father of Klaus Mann and Erika. But of course, the problem was that they were the very generation who were broken by the rise in 1933, that they had no fallback position. And they didn't, you know, once Hitler rose, they could merely go into exile and move sadly from city to city wondering when it was going to be over, you know. And Klaus eventually committed suicide after the war in about 48.
And from memory, one of the other challenges with that novel was that you had about four different characters called Klaus.
Yeah, what do you do? Everyone's called Klaus. It's like in Ireland, everyone's called Murphy or Mick or something. And you, what do you do? Four Micks. And so I thought, I'll have a dinner where it's deliberately established in order to honour the four Klauses. And just to, like, overdo it. So the reader is in no doubt. It's not just a mistake, this Klaus appearing, another Klaus appearing, another Klaus appearing. And, yeah, so there were four Klauses, yeah.
And I remember that section because you always knew which Klaus was which and you stopped
It was
to a think.
Huge... It was day... I went bald trying to get those Klauses separate from each other so the reader would know which Klaus was now speaking.
Well, let's move away from the Klauses and back to Ireland, which is overwhelmingly what people are asking questions about, including this person who says, as a fellow Irish person who has lived a lot of my life away from home, your books take me there. As an Irish man living in America, is writing them that for you, a way to take you back there?
Yeah, in certain ways, but you have to be very, very careful that, for example, I'm growing out of touch. And I know this because famously, Irish pubs close 2 days of the year, Christmas Day and Good Friday, closed. And people used to go nuts on a Good Friday. They would have big parties because you couldn't go to a pub. And it was a holiday. And I was talking to a friend of mine on the phone on Good Friday. And I said, sad for you guys over there because the pubs are shut. She said, what are you talking about? That changed 20 years ago. And I realised, oh, my God, imagine if I put that into a novel now. It would look so strange. But yeah, I suppose there is. You see, it isn't just Ireland. It's Enniscorthy. That all those people I was talking about, they're all dead in Enniscorthy. And so sometimes you're working, you realise you're rebuilding a world that's gone. And it's not exactly Ireland. It's Enniscorthy within Ireland. So I think that in Ireland, a lot of people... There are a lot of people who say who live outside Ireland, they don't think of Ireland as much as a particular place where they were brought up or where they know, rather than the whole country, part of which they might, like, people might not like Cork at all and be Irish, you know. A lot of people don't like Cork. And but yeah, you're working, rebuilding, adding, you know, creating the thing again. Yeah, I think that's true.
The film version of Brooklyn, part of that was filmed in Enniscorthy, I think. And somebody has asked here whether Long Island has been picked up to be filmed.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, these things take time and you can be lucky. With Brooklyn, we were lucky that Saoirse Ronan was at exactly the right age. We couldn't get the money first, but when the money came in, Saoirse was exactly the right age and she took the part. She'd never played an Irish woman before. She played, you know, the lovely Bones and Atonement, but she never played in her own voice, you know. And so it was very lucky that she was there. And yeah, they filmed it. People in Enniscorthy couldn't believe they were all up at 5 a.m. and ready to roll, you know. And people in Enniscorthy said, well, people in Enniscorthy are often up at 5, but they're on their way home from something, you know. That was an enormous shock to find the film stars where, you know, Saoirse was standing with her hot water bottle, you know, keeping her warm. Also, they made them swim. There's a scene in the Irish Sea, and they made them do it in March. And they made them do take after take. You think about it, take after take in March. And then it was shown in the town, which is a great evening we all had in the hotel, where everyone dressed up like Hollywood, you know, like Oscar night. And we looked much better than the Americans did. And... that was a lovely evening because the film opens in Enniscorthy. You know, when she goes down the street, everyone goes, oh my God, that's John Street. And so there was a street that I had been in as a kid, that I had remembered, that I had written in the novel, that was in the screenplay, and they filmed it in the street. And here we now were, one street away, watching it on a big screen. So that there was something lovely about that. And it was
so you're watching your memory, your memories, you're watching a sense of the past. What does it mean to watch characters who you have created and you have invented walking towards you on the screen?
I think with the particular figure of Jim Farrell, who's played by Donald Gleeson, who's an Irish actor, Donald added a lot to what I'd done in the novel. Gave one of the problems if you're Irish is that... I think it's the same if you're Scottish or maybe or Russian, is that when people write novels with Irish characters, male, of the male persuasion, the men are unreliable and they're often charming and they're very drunk and they're violent they're brooding. And, you know, a whole set of actors play these people and a whole set of writers write them. And they're cutting all his fingers off, or they're, you know, they're just, other a film called The Irishman. He'll never be at home with his pipe watching TV. He'll be in the mafia or something ridiculous, like IRA or something. And I thought I'd love to write a stable Irishman. And Jim is partly that, but Donald Gleeson in the film of Brooklyn made him more so and gave that a sort of glow. So it wasn't just dullness. It wasn't just some, you know, he gave it something. And I fed off that for the novel Long Island. I used what Donald had given me as a performer. And I went one more time at it.
And somebody else has asked whether you will return again to these characters, whether you will follow up on Long Island.
I don't know what to do. You see, the problem is that I thought I'd ended the book. You know, I mean, I really did. I put a lot of work into ending the book. I put a lot of thought into it. I read it over. I thought, well, that's the end of the book. Well, I have a website and you can go into contact and then you can click and you can get me directly, you know. And everyone says, what are you thinking about ending a book like that? Like, what are we going to do? I was going to write, I suppose read some other book, but I mean, I honestly thought I had brought it towards, I mean, completion. But seemingly I haven't. But I haven't a clue. I haven't an idea in my head. And so I don't know what to do now.
Somebody has written here, Brooklyn highlights the anxieties of a woman coming of age. Can you speak to where your inspiration for writing a tender female character comes from as a middle-aged man?
Yeah, I can, actually. Just my aunts. You know, in other words, that scene I'm talking about, of a small town, and my mother's two younger sisters don't marry until later, and they're more or less in our house every day. They wouldn't knock the door in. They'd just walk in, and they'd be welcome. And my father had a sister who never married, and my two nearest siblings were sisters. And so all these women would gather, and there's nothing more interesting than a gathering like that on a, you know, in my parents' bedroom with my father downstairs. The men wouldn't, you know, all of them talking. And it is back with that business of, they talked a lot about style. You know, and Auntie Harriet could talk about a ladder in her stocking, and they'd talk about nail varnish that might cure the ladder. But they would go through coats and the cardigan my mother wanted to swap for something with Auntie Maeve, who wasn't swapping anything this season. And, you know, could go on, and shoes. And what did anyone think about a handbag that so-and-so thought? And then, honestly, you'd be sitting there, I'd be, say, 6 years old, and I'm sitting watching this as moving from voice to voice, and I don't know anything more than that. So I just know what happened in that room. And so we're talking about a young woman coming of age and me being, I'm not middle-aged, I'm old. And it is just the memory of all those ways they talked and how much they laughed, and then they would go dead serious, but dead serious over the smallest matter, like a bedspread. That you know, that's what, I don't think that bedspread is right for that bed. And my mother would say, but what's wrong with it?
And so as you remember those scenes, those scenes that had such an impact on you, is it always the dialogue and the conversation, or are there other sort of moments and details that stick with you?
Oh, well, In the case of one of the aunts, there are a lot of things in Long Island, just details like that. She was in her 40s and she was getting married, and in Enniscorthy, what do? You walk up the aisle? And she said she didn't want to do that, that she thought she'd like to get married in Rome. And that's in the book. And so what I'm doing is I'm revisiting a whole time when she was getting ready. Like, what clothes do you wear in Rome if you're getting married? And, like, do you wear white? And then, you know, do you wear ivory? Was another color. Oh, ivory is a very good color, you know. And like, what do you do? Like, how? What do you do with, you know, the collar? And should it be how long below the knee? And oh, in Rome, people, I'm sure skirts are longer. And honestly, I was at those conversations, and everyone was involved. We were all sitting there with Harriet worrying about Rome. Yeah, it would be the whole atmosphere. Not just the dialogue, but faces and also attitudes towards things, you know.
And what about the priest? Because the priest would be the person who might give you advice. I don't know whether they'd give you advice about what to wear in Rome, but was the priest in Enniscorthy you know, a figure of power, the person you would go to ask those questions?
Not by 1976. But yeah, when my aunt was getting married, she had to go to the priest to get a letter to say that she was who she said she was. I mean, who else could know except the priest? And then they set up all the stuff for her in Rome. He found another priest in Rome who said he'd do the wedding in a little church in Rome. So they were incredibly benign sometimes. And also, it's very easy now to jump on a bandwagon of kicking priests around. And I've not done it so far in a novel, just because I feel it's so easy to do that suddenly the priest gets all predatory. I think that's a cliche, because it's partly been true. But there's no need to put it into a novel, every novel. You know, it's just, there are times when, you know, in Brooklyn, for example, I very deliberately used what we would call an emigrant priest, meaning a priest who looked after Irish people in, especially the English cities. That if you're ever in trouble in Manchester or Liverpool, you would go straight to the church and be a priest who would look after you, who would get your home if necessary, who would raise money for something. And it was the same in Boston, and it was the same in Philadelphia, and probably the same in various parts of New York State. So I needed to put that in as an image that I thought was closer to what I needed for the novel than having the priest being in any way venal or in any way, you know, sinful.
Now, Colm,
I just said sinful. I don't mean, you know, but you know what I mean.
Colm, I have to ask you this question because I have no idea what it means. Can you ask Colm to do the tongue thing? Does that question mean anything to you?
Yeah.
Is it one you want to answer or would you rather not?
Look, I was an altar boy in Enniscorthy, and an altar boy is a very special moment that a priest comes to the house and says, Colm, we'd like Colm to be an altar boy. And it means that they've been watching you in some way and they think you have a special devotion. You're aged about 8 or 9 at this point, and that you're seen to have, like you bow your head or you're just seen to be respectful. And then my mother would say, "Did you like? Why are they picking you to be an altar boy? I thought you've done something wrong." But this is, anyway, you have to go and train as an altar boy. One of the things you have to do as an altar boy, at this time, I'm talking, say, 1965, it's the beginning of the Mass in English, but it's still where they don't allow members of the laity to touch the wafer, to touch the communion. It's put on your tongue by the priest. The problem is that if a bit of it falls, it could go into the carpet or the line, and it could be, you know, hoovered up. And it is literally the body and blood of our... I mean, you're explained as an altar boy. Boys, remember, this is the body and blood of our Lord Jesus Christ, our Saviour, and the smallest part of it is also the body and blood. And we're all watching the priest, oh, Jesus, the little bit of it, the smallest sliver of it, if it fell, it would be there. Probably could walk on it. And, oh, my God. So what you have is a thing called a pattern, and your job is to put it under the chin of every single person who's getting communion. So everyone comes to the altar rails and they're all kneeling and they're waiting and the priest comes along. He has the hosts in the ciborium, I think the ciborium, and you have the pattern under, ready to put under the chin of the person. And it's all very solemn. And then you realise, oh my God, that a very large man in Enniscorthy who you'd know would have a tiny little skinny tongue, which you would stick out. And then a very thin woman could have a very tongue like a trout, you know, and somebody, the next person could not stick out their tongue immediately and the priest would have to wait, you know, come on, get over it. And then we'd go, and eventually the host would go onto their tongue. Now, the big problem, next problem is that you learn things such as, there are many questions we must never ask. And especially if you're an 8-year-old and a 9-year-old and a thought has come into your head and you realise that if I ask this, it could be the most trouble I'd ever get into. Because obviously, if these tongues are taking in the host and it is the body and blood of our Lord Jesus Christ, there, living being, living alive, on your tongue. The question is, what happens next? Like, you move on to the next person, but what does the host do? It goes down into your gut. I suppose it goes down slowly, I suppose, into your stomach. At what point is it or isn't it still the body and blood of our Lord Jesus Christ? Because, like, it's got to go. Like, there's only one way it can now go. And it's a big problem. Like, I mean, I've never understood why it isn't a huge issue in theology. and why, you know, we talk about Pope Francis's view on this versus, you know, John Paul II versus that poor man in the middle, Ratzinger. You know, like, wow, like, surely they must have thoughts on this. Like, is there a certain point in the stomach when, you know, when the lower gut gives way to the, oh my God, to the bowel? Like, that's the moment where our Lord Jesus Christ ascends into heaven from the host. And you... I mean, this isn't a joke. And I'm sorry you're laughing. And because I'm 8 or 9, and I'm watching this a lot and thinking on the way home, like, is there one of my father's, say, sister, she'd listen to you if you asked her something. Could I ever ask her that? And I wonder what she'd say, but I never did, so I don't know.
Well, thank you so much to the person who asked that question. And I would also like to do a special call out to the woman who snorted with laughter in the second row. You know who you are, and you have made my night. Here at the Sydney Writers' Festival, we've been with Irish writer and indeed raconteur Colm Tobin. His latest novel is Long Island. Please do thank him.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Colm Tobin, charming us all at the 2025 Sydney Writers' Festival. There are plenty more conversations with writers and about writing here on ABC Radio National. You can find them by following The Bookshelf, where every week with Cassie McCullough we review new fiction. But there are also plenty of panels and interviews that we record at writers' festivals too. And don't forget our sister program, The Book Show with Claire Nichols, because it's also full of writers and ideas. And I'll be back next time with another collection of literary, lyrical moments. I'm Kate Evans. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.